It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up in just a few moments, a guest looks at the allure and the potential destructive power of guns and gun culture. First, Governor Scott Walker is a man who doesn't like to sit in one place for too long. He spends a lot of time on the road, whether in Wisconsin or out of state. And when it comes to his campaign, he can log hundreds of miles a day hitting vital media markets. To get an idea of what life is like on the campaign trail in one of the hottest races for governor, WPR News sent reporter Rich Kramer to tag along.
The campaign machine has started early with a morning press conference at a Milwaukee Firefighters Union and a private meeting in Wisconsin Dells. The next stop is in the far western Wisconsin city of Hudson at Viking Electronics. The event, like many Walker campaign stops, is at a manufacturing plant and is closed to the public. The governor arrives with former governor Tommy Thompson, and the men are given a tour of the facility.
So this is where you guys make that magic happen with all those new products, right?
Yeah, this is where we develop all the new products.
Away from the machines, a small group of workers have been gathered by the company. After a brief introduction by a company owner, Tommy Thompson roars into the mic.
I want to tell you that Scott Walker has made Wisconsin once again the pride of the Midwest. And I want to make sure he's able to continue doing that. That's why I'm traveling with him. And he is having a lot of success. And I'll tell you, he is going to have even more success next term.
Then it's Walker's turn to speak. He is smooth and confident, traits perfected from more than two decades in politics. He starts with a story about buying Javon Walker Packers jerseys on the cheap and links that to a recent jobs estimate.
The reason I brought number 84 out is because just last week, just a few days ago, we learned that Wisconsin last month created 8,400 new private sector jobs.
Walker attributes the growth to his economic policies and suggests the state would be closer to his goal of creating 250,000 jobs if it weren't for unions protesting his restrictions on collective bargaining.
That first year, there were protests, and then there were recalls against me. So for the first 2 years, we were kind of stuck because a lot of businesses said, what do they need most? They need certainty.
He then shifts to the future, describing his plan for the next 4 years.
It's a simple plan. It's about ensuring that everyone who wants a job can find a job.
Tax cuts, another tuition freeze, fighting Obamacare, job training, and mandatory drug testing for people on government assistance round out the rest of Walker's speech. These have been common themes on the campaign trail. When he's done, Walker greets the workers. His handlers eye their watches while security guards keep watch over the crowd.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Then, just as suddenly as they arrived, the Walker campaign leaves Hudson and drives to a St. Paul airport to catch a plane to Eau Claire. Reporters aren't allowed on his flights. In Eau Claire, he visits Johnson Lithographics, a printing company nearly 100 years old. After another obligatory tour, Walker and Thompson deliver speeches nearly identical to those given earlier in the day. Thompson's introduction, Walker's jersey story, and his plans for next term. After meeting with workers, Walker speaks with reporters from local TV stations.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
What's up? Well, great to be back in the Chippewa Valley.
He talks about his love of visiting the Chippewa Valley, which happens to be a region full of voters prone to political swings. When asked why he prefers private campaign stops at businesses, Walker says they're more effective than public gatherings.
At town hall meetings, most of the time, what you get are activists on the right and the left, and you don't really get everyday working people. When you come right to the workplace, you get just the opposite.
The final stop for the Walker campaign is a private evening fundraiser at a nearby country club. Media are not invited. It's just another day in the final push leading to what's expected to be a close election. But Walker says it's not draining. He says getting out of the Capitol to meet people is an invigorating and important part of being governor. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Our next guest, author Craig Collins, has a relationship with guns that stretches back to his childhood when he was raised around guns and gun culture. In his family, guns were part of daily life, like they are for a lot of people in Wisconsin, much like driving a car. Collins' family history is also closely tied to the rise and spread of gun culture in 19th century America, in which he says Wisconsin played a key role. But he's also directly experienced the destructive power of guns. In a new book, he looks at firearms from the perspective of his deep history with them and the lessons he learned about them, trying to puzzle out how guns influence each of us individually and America as a whole. Craig Collins joins us now in our studio. His new book is Thunder in the Mountains, A Portrait of American Gun Culture. He's speaking, by the way, at Boswell Books in Milwaukee Wednesday night at 7. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, you, not in the book, but elsewhere, have referred to Boys in the Hood, the movie, as one of the things that inspired you to write this book, seeing how guns affected the lives of inner-city young men. And you had a realization in Winnemucca, Nevada. You were living the same story in some ways. How so?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I actually went and saw that movie. It had a profound impact on me. And, as I think we were chatting earlier, when I was 13, I went on a deer hunting trip, my first deer hunt with my dad and two older brothers, and my grandfather had given me a 30-30 Winchester, just like the one that Chuck Connors used to use in The Rifleman, the one with the lever action. And I was kind of sitting on a rock and was wondering how many shells I had in the gun, and I was cocking the gun just to check how many bullets I had in, and I snapped the lever shut, and I felt a little pinch. My finger slipped off the trigger guard. I felt a little tiny pinch on my skin, and I reflexively said, ow, and I pulled my finger back, and boom, the gun went off, and I shot myself in the foot. So that was, ever since then, anytime I see something that has gunshots in it or somebody getting shot, it has almost a visceral effect. So I was watching the Boys in the Hood, and it really had a profound impact on me, and I thought, that would be really horrible to live in a place where, the threat of gun violence hangs over you like the sword of Damocles and like in central Los Angeles, and how awful that would be. And then I thought back to myself, and when I lived in Winnemucca, Nevada, which is a small ranching and railroad and mining town in north central Nevada with a population then of about 3,000, five classmates and I were all shot, all accidentally. And three were killed, one was permanently brain damaged, one was severely wounded in the neck and torso, and then I pretty much got off easy with my foot. And essentially, I started seeing similarities between some of the places where you think of gun violence and then these small towns in the West where they occurred and I experienced it.
And we think of a contrast in a lot of ways between that urban environment and guns and where you grew up, a rural or kind of out-of-the-way place people would think of it. What was gun culture like growing up for you?
Well, everybody had a gun, and it was, when I tell people the story, they say, my God, you were 13 and you were carrying around a 30-30. Well, that was nothing unusual about that whatsoever. We'd go take guns up into the hills and, shoot rabbits, that sort of thing, all the time. So everybody had a gun, and, the issue is that the gun casualty rates in the small towns are as high or higher than they are in the places that we typically think of gun violence in places like, Los Angeles, South Chicago, Baltimore, that sort of thing. It's just that in the small towns, they tend to have accidents and suicides rather than homicides, but the gun casualties are extremely high. So people had guns, and I had friends, and they were all accidentally shot. They were playing cops and robbers and pulled the trigger and had a gun and, bullet in the chamber. They were out hunting, hit the trigger, and the gun accidentally went off, things like that. So the gun casualties were extremely high. So if you were a boy in Winnemucca, there were about 300 boys in 6th through 12th grade, you had about a 1 in 50 chance of getting shot.
So some people might say, well, no offense, but maybe you weren't trained well enough to handle that gun and be careful with it, or the other boys in these accidents didn't have the appropriate training safety precautions in place. Does that make a difference? Is that part of the problem?
Well, I actually had taken a 3-weekend-long NRA gun safety course right before I went hunting. My dad made me take it, and apparently I didn't pay attention at the right parts or something, but it was actually a very good course. But that's not quite the issue. The issue is that young boys are drawn to guns like magnets to metal. They just are. And they don't have the capabilities to really handle such a lethal weapon, in my opinion and my experience. They don't have the attention span. They don't have the kind of the cognitive awareness that this is a lethal weapon. They don't have the understanding that this could happen to me because they all think that they're invincible. And it just creates a really dangerous situation when you put boys and guns together.
We're talking about guns, gun culture, and its effect on children with Craig Collins talking about his new book, Thunder in the Mountain. You can join the conversation. What is your experience with guns? What do you think about them? Are they a common part of your life, just a natural part of the landscape, or a virtual alien artifact? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Craig Collins stays with us. He's the author of the book Thunder in the Mountains, A Portrait of American Gun Culture. We're talking about gun culture and children in particular. We'd like you to chime in with your thoughts. Do you allow your kids to shoot, to hunt? Do you think there's a link between shooting accidents involving children and how we keep our guns in the house? Would you like to see tougher laws or a change in the culture in any way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Craig, before we go to the calls, I want to get into some of the history in your book. You trace the rise in what we think of as gun culture coming from the Midwest, in part Wisconsin, via the West, partly via your own ancestors.
Yeah, in the book, I basically looked at my own family history for a couple reasons. One, because there are some real characters there, and it makes for some good stories. But the other thing, America is unique as a country because we're the only developed country that has such an embedded gun culture. No other developed country has anything even close to what we have in America. And that didn't happen by accident. There was a confluence of two things that, in my opinion, caused the rise of the gun culture. And number one was the Civil War. And number two was geography. And after the Civil War, men and boys came home and they all had guns. And then they all went west. Tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them, and they all brought guns. The West was not a place you would ever think to go without a gun. It just wasn't a smart thing to do. And Wisconsin was one of the jumping off points to go west. And when the guns went west, they stayed. And the gun culture spread out from there. And so many of the things that you see involving the gun culture really began in the western mining towns and the small towns in the West, and they spread throughout the rest of the country. And my family actually came to Wisconsin. I'm related to Colonel James Collins, who came here to fight in the Black Hawk Wars in the 1830s. My great-grandfather, Benjamin Franklin Collins, was born on a farm near Richland Center in 1858. His father was killed in the Civil War, so he was orphaned, and he went west. And he was a rancher, and he prospected for gold, and he was funded by many of his relatives in Wisconsin. And then in 1909, he struck gold in Jarbidge Canyon, Nevada, hit a very rich vein of gold, and he triggered the last gold rush in the United States. And that was, ironically, was about 10 miles from where I shot myself in the foot. So
let's go to our callers now. We've got Marie on the line in Green Bay. Marie, hi.
Hi. I think this is a really important topic, and I have really strong feelings on it. My kids, a girl and two boys, have never been allowed to be around guns of any kind. In fact, before they were allowed to have play dates, I ask if there are guns in the house and don't let them go if there is. And I feel like we really do need to change our culture. I think we can. We changed our culture on cigarettes in a generation, so we can change our culture dramatically if we want to. But I wanted to kind of disagree with the guest on the point that he made that boys are drawn to guns naturally. They're taught to like guns, and I taught my boys from the time they were little that guns are not funny or fun or cool, and they weren't drawn to them, and they didn't make their Legos into guns or anything of the kind. So I don't think it's a natural thing.
All right. Marie, thanks for the call. You said boys are drawn to guns. I don't know that you used the word naturally, Craig.
Yeah, I would disagree. The caller makes an excellent point, but I would like to clarify that I never said that boys are naturally drawn to guns. Whatever the reason, it could be cultural, it could be whatever. Gunshots are the second leading cause of death among boys. They outnumber the next nine leading causes of death combined. So it's a huge problem, and gun casualties in the United States are a uniquely male problem. 97% of all gun casualties in the United States involve a man or a boy. So it's a remarkable thing. one of the things that I would say that one of the boys in my book that I write about, his mother was much like the caller who just called in. She didn't want anything to do with guns. She didn't want her son to have guns. He was best friends with my son, and whenever we would go to a movie, she wouldn't even let me take him to a movie that had any guns in it. That's how adamant she was. And when the boy was 15, he climbed up into the family attic where the father had hidden a rifle, and he found it, and he shot and killed himself, and it was quite tragic. So, you know, you can take all those precautions and you can take all those measures, but the bottom line is that if you have a boy in the house, if you're a parent, in my opinion, you should either not have a gun in the house, or it should have a trigger lock, or be kept in a safe, or better yet, be kept in a locker at a gun range off premises.
Thanks for the call, Marie. We've got Adam with us now in Horicon. Adam, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd just like to say I'm a gunsmith, and I'm part of the Wisconsin Army National Guard, and I've been around guns since I was about 3 years old when I got my first BB gun, pellet gun, from my grandpa. I've shot everything from small arms to anti-tank. It's not the training. It's not that we need stiffer laws. It's the fact that media and social media, we immortalize these people like gangsters and rappers that say, well, I'm pissed off, I'm gonna go shoot somebody. And that's where, like, all of our heroes, like, I grew up with John Wayne and stuff like that. Other people are growing up with Tupac, Notorious B.I.G., and that's what's popular now. And when people want to solve their problems, they turn to, well, how do people do it on TV? How do people do it in songs and stuff like that, what you hear and what you see every single day? And that's what...
Gotcha, Adam. I want to get our guest in. Craig, first of all, media causing unhealthy attitudes toward firearms, he says, and he's obviously comfortable with firearms in his life.
Well, he sounds a lot like me, except I've never fired an anti-tank gun. It sounds like kind of like fun, but I've never done it. Anyway, you know, I would have to say that when I was growing up, you know, we didn't have rap music, and still the gun casualties for young boys in the Mountain West was extraordinarily high, and many of my friends were shot. So I don't think that that had a great deal to do with it. I do think that the media may play a role. But I'm not 100% certain on that. And I would say that in the inner city, boys and people in general, they get shot due to homicide. In the Mountain West, which is 8 states, which is 1/3 of the entire country, and the gun rates are 3 to 20 times higher than they are anywhere else. These are boys who die in accidents and in, you know, self-inflicted gunshots. So they're not, it has nothing to do really with the rap culture.
Adam, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, I'm guessing you hear from a lot of people who are, you know, gun owners, handle their weapons safely, raise their kids responsibly, saying your message is going too far. Guns aren't that bad. How do you respond?
Well, I would say to that, there's a couple things. Well, first of all, in my book, I don't really take a stance. There's no editorializing. I tell stories that have to do with guns and are set in the gun country. And I leave the heavy lifting to the reader and let them decide. And I purposely don't editorialize or stand on a soapbox and deliver a political screed, because that, frankly, would be boring. But in my personal opinions, what I would say is that one of the things we need to do in this country is develop a national gun database. We really have none. The Center for Disease Control collects about 7 pieces of data whenever somebody gets shot. When a jetliner crashes, we collect millions of pieces of data, and we need to develop a robust database and really look at the data and have that lead us to some answers and some solutions to the problems.
Since you shot yourself in the foot while hunting, have you fired guns? Have you gone hunting again?
Well, about 6 months later, I went hunting. You know, as they say in Nevada, get back on the horse that threw you. So I was back hunting again. I'm not anti gun per se. I'm not anti-hunting, and I've hunted. I visit relatives in Idaho, and I enjoy hunting. But I do have a big issue with guns and the proliferation of guns, and especially as how they relate to children.
Briefly, a message for parents out there.
My simple message would be that if you have children in the house, and if you have specifically boys in the house, it's the statistics say it is extremely unwise and unsafe to have a gun in the house. And if you do have a gun in the house, it absolutely needs to be locked at all times, or better yet, be kept off premises.
All right, Craig, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
That's Craig Collins. His book is Thunder in the Mountains, A Portrait of American Gun Culture. You can catch him at Boswell Books in Milwaukee. That's Wednesday night at 7, and there's more info on the Boswell Books website. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickard, will be back with us tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a new exhibit that just opened at the Field Museum over in Chicago, debunking stereotypes of voodoo or voodoo traditions. First, last month, labor group Wisconsin Jobs Now filed a complaint with the Walker administration under the state's century-old living wage clause. Now, that law states that the minimum wage shall not be less than a living wage. The group called on the state to investigate whether the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a living wage and determine whether or not it ought to be raised. The administration says it checked it out and concluded that the minimum wage should remain as is. Wisconsin Jobs Now announced today that it's suing the administration over that study. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Gilman Halstead has been following this story. He joins us here in the studio. Gilman, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
So tell us what this lawsuit is exactly over. This isn't directly to increase the minimum wage. Yeah, but it wouldn't, like, their lawsuit isn't saying change the minimum wage now, right?
No, but the goal of the suit clearly is to get the wage raised, and the organizations involved have talked about wanting to raise it to $10.10. But the suit itself basically is trying to do what you said, which is to force the governor's administration to establish a wage advisory council, as has been done in the past, and do a thorough investigation to see whether this minimum wage equals a living wage as defined in the state statute, which, of course, says that it has to ensure reasonable comfort, decency, and moral well-being.
Now, the state answered that complaint and says, okay, we took a look. No, this law doesn't mean we need to increase the minimum wage. Do we know what the state's study or investigation consisted of?
Well, the document that they sent back to the complainants, who there were 100 complainants who filed these complaints. According to Wisconsin Jobs Now, none of them were ever contacted by the Department of Workforce Development. But they said they looked at the department said they looked at the complaints and determined that there was no reasonable way to say that minimum wage was not a living wage. They made some other comments. They said some of these people are making more than the minimum wage. In fact, one or two of them, I'm not sure how many, were making as much as $15 an hour. But Wisconsin Jobs Now says they selected the complainants to cover a wide range of wages that include people making the minimum wage. They also said, the department said that it did not, that the complaints indicated that in some cases that these people were not wanting for necessities of life. And they also said some of them, I'm assuming those making the lower end of the wage at $7.25, were also getting food stamps, other government benefits, that the implication would be effectively raise their wage.
Now, looking at the statute, and you just quoted from it, I mean, is that pretty much it, this statement about what the wage should be without, I guess, a methodology saying here's how you determine if the real wage is a living wage?
The methodology is to establish a wage commission.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that the lawsuit asks them to do. It basically says go back to the beginning from when we made these complaints, look at them more carefully, and then establish this wage commission, which will look at it even more carefully and come up with a proposal for actually raising the wage. It's been done in the past by lots of governors. Most recently, 2007, Governor Doyle did it, but Governor Thompson did it as well.
Have these past wage commissions been done under the law in question, the one
yes.
we're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, they've. I mean, it's not in that same sentence about defining a living wage, but in that same section of the statutes, it talks about the establishment of a wage advisory council.
Now let's talk about the arguments on both sides as to whether that current minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is or isn't a living wage. What is the Wisconsin Jobs Now group saying about minimum wage as a living wage?
Well, they're saying that there are a lot of people in the retail industry who aren't making enough and therefore do have to take food stamps or find some other way to make the enough money to live on, and they contest the allegations coming from those who say there's no need to raise it, that this is only for young people, that there are people who have worked as long as 20 or 30 years at the minimum wage and can barely make a living and have to make really tough decisions about paying rent and electricity and getting groceries as a result of that. And some of the other things they said, there's a lot of the time it ends up being a part-time job because in lots of the food service industry in particular, people will be scheduled to come in and then sent home when there's no business. So that it's just basically a difficult situation to face, and that one way of addressing this, and other states have raised it, is to raise the wage.
Now, I understand the state's response to the initial complaint included a study from the Wisconsin Restaurant Association.
Right.
What did that study say?
Well, they didn't really do it. They paid for it to be done. It said that the result would be 16,000 people losing their jobs, 2,000 of them in Milwaukee, and because the restaurants would either have to raise the price of their of the food they're selling, the services they're offering, or they would have to have fewer people doing the work. And they also do contend that the majority of people who are actually making this wage are young, not much older than 25 is what was determined there. And that the allegation from Wisconsin Jobs Now is that that's what influenced the Department of Workforce Development to make the decision not to pursue this any further, although I don't think there was reference to the study in what the DWD sent back.
And have you heard anything from the Restaurant Association in response to today's news about this lawsuit?
Yes. I talked to Ed Lump, who is the director, and he said that in his view it is he repeated the arguments that were found in the study, and he said in his view this is a campaign stunt, that this is an effort being funded by labor unions. He mentioned particularly the Service Employees International Union, who are spending lots of money against Governor Walker, and that this is an effort to discredit the governor less than it is a real focus on raising the wage, although I asked Jobs Now, and they said, no, we want to raise the wage. It's not a stunt.
And have we heard from Governor Walker or
no.
his campaign on this lawsuit?
No.
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 Okay.
They have not commented. The Department of Workforce Development's John Dipko sent out a release today sort of reviewing what had been sent in the complaints and mentioning the fact that some of the people who had complained were making as much as $15 an hour.
And speaking of the election, has Mary Burke made anything of this ongoing effort from
Wisconsin? Well, she has said she's in favor of I haven't heard her comment on the lawsuit, but she's in favor of raising the wage to $10.10 an hour. She has said that.
Okay. Just briefly before we let you go, I know you've been covering the race for attorney general. I know we just had a debate on that between Susan Happ and Brad Schimmel. Any breaking news from the Friday debate?
Well, I guess the breaking news that night was which laws each of them would defend or not defend or would look carefully at before defending. And the focus in the debate was on the law that requires or prohibits coordination between outside groups and political campaigns, candidate campaigns. And now... at the debate, I believe Happ changed his position and said that
Schimmel.
I'm sorry, Schimmel changed his position and said that he might defend it. He'd look at it carefully, but and initially he had said he agreed with Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen that he would not defend it. Well, actually, I think the point Schimmel made was that it's going to be defended. Mm-hmm. There's been an attorney to represent the Government Accountability Board. The law is now on hold. It's been ruled by a state judge that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the laws or rules actually at the center of the John Doe investigation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right, Gil, thanks as always for joining us. I've been speaking with WPR criminal justice reporter Gilman Halstead. It's Halloween week, which means there are scary movies and stories all over the place. One of the most common themes in scary stories is the voodoo stereotype. Black magic using voodoo dolls brings people back from the grave with ancient spells. A new exhibit at the Field Museum in Chicago aims to replace that Hollywood stereotype of voodoo with the real-life version of voodoo, a religion practiced in Haiti. Janet Hong is with us here to tell us about that exhibit. It's called Voodoo, Sacred Powers of Haiti. She's the project manager for exhibitions at the Field Museum in Chicago. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Rob, thanks a bunch for having me.
Well, let's start with that pronunciation. Not voodoo, but voodoo.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the way you pronounce it in Haiti. And also, increasingly, scholars of religion here in the U.S. and around the world pronounce it that way, voodoo. And that's how the Library of Congress says it, too.
And how is that Hollywood stereotype I mentioned different than what people actually do in real life?
Well, Hollywood has been riffing on misconceptions of voodoo since the silent era. And voodoo in Haiti is a complete religion. It's got its own theology and clergy and holidays and pilgrimages. It's a religion that grew out of a creative amalgamation of West African traditions, the traditions of the native Indians who lived in the Caribbean, and elements of Catholicism. So it's a complete religion that's practiced in Haiti.
And I understand in some ways it's even more than a religion, kind of a way of life too. Can you talk about some of the non-religious sides of voodoo?
Yeah. Well, you know, most people in Haiti say that they're Christian, but people also say that Haiti is 110% voodoo. And that's because it's just interstitched in the everyday life of Haitians. So for public gatherings and fun stuff and for holidays, people have some element of voodoo in there, whether it's ritual drumming or honoring your ancestors or honoring voodoo spirits. They're called loa. They're sort of like the saints of voodoo.
And I understand that a lot of what we know about voodoo emerged in the slave era and in resistance to slavery.
Yeah. That's right. Voodoo was something that enabled a slave revolution in Haiti, and that's why Haiti became the first country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery. That was in 1804, so many decades before that happened in our country. Voodoo was a galvanizing force for all these different ethnic groups that came from different parts of Africa, and the Taino and Arawak Indians who were in the Caribbean, to gather together and inspire them to revolt against French colonialists and win their freedom. So in that regard, voodoo was considered something very dangerous, and it was a practice that largely went underground, and you can see how misconceptions would arise around voodoo.
And again, in the stereotypical version, it seems that voodoo is something of the past that occasionally percolates up in the present. That's not true. It's a very much a modern-day thing, right?
That's right. I mean, voodoo has had periods of persecution and suppression, and then sometimes there's a lot of national pride that surfaces every 30 years or so in Haitian history. One person explained it to me as sort of like Shinto in Japan. Voodoo is something that gives Haitians a sense of national identity and cultural pride, even though, you know, you might not profess yourself to be a voodooist, just the way most Japanese are not going to say, I'm Shintoist. It's there for a lot of public gatherings, and it gives you a sense of being Haitian and pride in your history.
Is it localized in Haiti, or have people who have emigrated outside of Haiti carried it with them?
Vodou has different names throughout the Caribbean, and, something related is in Brazil called Candomblé. It's called Santeria in Cuba. And the voodoo in Louisiana, in New Orleans, does largely come originally from vodou in Haiti. So it's kind of confusing here in the U.S. because we grew up with this idea of voodoo, which is the more secularized practice, and allows room for pop culture. But there are definitely practitioners of voodoo in North American cities, definitely in Canada also.
Well, let's take a visit to your exhibit now. What do we see?
Well, spectacular artworks. It's not quite precise to call them artworks. To me, they're very beautiful, so I always think of them as art. But they're ritual objects that were used in vodou practices. None of them were made for art museums, but were actually used in initiation ceremonies and temples and home use. And they range from beautifully decorated objects spangled with sequins that would go on an altar to figures about as tall as me that represent different vodou spirits. And they're really bursting with personality. They represent spirits, everything from the spirit of soldiers to the power of grandmas to love and luxury. So it's over 300 objects, and it's something really worth seeing.
Now, when I think of an old-fashioned museum-type exhibit of a culture, I'm thinking kind of, there's this here with a little label and this here with a label. As I understand it, you've tried to include voices of followers and practitioners. How did you do that?
Yeah, we're trying to explain vodou from the point of view of vodouists, of practitioners. So right there on the decks with objects are videos of people describing their own beliefs. What happens in an animal sacrificed, or what do you do if you're a vodou priestess, and how do you interpret dreams if you're a vodouist? And I also got to mention that almost none of the objects are behind glass in this exhibition. So you will have a very visceral connection with the object when they're right out in the open.
I know it can be difficult when you've got things that have spiritual value or religious value to people being displayed as an exhibit for non-believers. Was that an issue? Were there things that you couldn't do or you had to explain in a certain way?
Oh, we thought about that a lot. Now, these objects are from a specific collection in Haiti, in Pétionville, Haiti, and many Haitians have never seen this kind of material, especially objects from a Bizongo secret society. So the objects did go through a deconsecration process. I don't know exactly what that ritual meant or entailed, but although they were officially desacralized, as it said, they still have a lot of residual spiritual power. So the lenders of the objects asked us to not put them in glass cases and keep them out in the open. In fact, some people would even say that if they were put in glass boxes, they would just shatter the glass boxes.
Now, you mentioned these aren't art objects. They aren't created just as art objects, but they have an artistic value.
Yes.
Do we hear anything from the people who made them or anything about the artistic side of it in the exhibit?
I wish we knew more. Many of the objects were created by people in a secret society.
Now, so you don't put your name on it, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Secret societies are a specific feature of vodou, and it grows from the tradition of runaway slaves in Haiti, starting in the 1700s, and meeting native Caribbeans there. So there are still secret societies in Haiti now, and I have to say I don't know the names of the artisans who made these spectacular objects.
Now, I often think of the Field Museum and, of course, think of dinosaurs and things like that. So why an exhibit on religion, too?
Well, we're a museum of science, but we're also a museum of human cultures, of anthropology. And that necessarily means that there's a lot of religion here at the Field Museum. It's something that we study very seriously. So, you know, everything from a Cro-Magnon burial 30,000 years ago in France to explorations of so-called major religions around the world, we're interested in all that. And when we saw this opportunity to explore this very misunderstood tradition here in the United States, we grabbed it. We went for it.
And briefly, what are you hearing from the people who have seen this exhibit so far?
That it's very moving. They know right away that these are powerful objects. And I think many of our visitors are used to seeing Christian iconography, like a Christian cross, and realizing that there are layers of meaning that Vodouists put on that kind of symbol that's new to them. So a Christian cross is also overlaid with the African idea of spirits at the crossroads. People find it very moving to lock eyes with the sculptural figures portraying different Vodou saints, or loi, as they're called. And people love it. They're very enjoying themselves.
Great. Janet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's Janet Hong, Project Manager for Exhibitions at the Field Museum in Chicago.